Welcome, everyone, to this Webster Support Technical Exchange session. Today's topic is debugging top 5 memory problems in IBM Integration Bus. The presenters are Vivek Glover and Amar Shah. Vivek is Level 2 Technical Support Engineer for IBM Integration Bus Webster Message Broker. His responsibilities include troubleshooting customers' real-time problems worldwide and providing resolutions. Amar is a Level 3 Technical Leader for IBM Integration Bus and WebSphere Message Broker. His responsibilities include providing defect support to worldwide customers. Additionally, he is responsible for driving serviceability improvements to the product for better troubleshooting and diagnostic facilities. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Vivek.
Thank you, Kathy. Hello, everyone. My name is Vivek Grover. Thanks for joining today's session. We'll start with chart 2. So today we will cover 5 of the common problems around memory usage that we see in support world. Problem 1, message parsing and data flow engine memory usage, how they're related. Problem 2, memory growth with seen with large messages or large files. Problem 3, we'll talk about differences between memory leak and a memory fragmentation. And then problem 4 around memory growth in the JVM component. And then problem 5, we'll talk about memory growth due to thread caching of objects within the broker, within the data flow engine. So let's begin with chart number 3. Right, so first one is on message parsing and its effects on data flow engine memory usage. Chart 4, please. A brief introduction here. So normally in IIB or message broker, you receive a message or data in one format. You transform it and then output it in another format and send it to the desired destination. The parser takes the input message bitstream, converts it into a logical structure called a message tree, which can then be used in the message flow to change the format to change the data, and the serializer component then converts it back into the output bitstream. And this is the parsing is applied to both header and the body of the message. There are different parsers available in IIB, such as XML-NSC, DFDL, Blob, SOAP, MIME, JMS Map, JMS Stream. And in reference to our session today, obviously, as the message complexity varies, or as, you know, the message size varies or message format varies, the way you would parse these messages can have varied effects on the memory usage of the data flow engine component. For instance, if you have a large tree or a large message tree or a large number of times a message tree copy is made within the message flow, you could end up with a very high memory usage on the data flow engine. Basically, the size of the message tree is directly proportional to the size of the messages being processed and the logic that is coded within the flow. So both the pieces are very relevant, and we'll take a look at both these pieces today. So let's move on to chart 5. So as we said, you will receive a message in one format, transform it, and then output it in another format. And here's an example where we see an input message received in a CVS format. That's the input bitstream on top left side. And it needs to be transformed so that the output message is in XML format on the bottom right. So you've coded a message flow here where on the input node, the parser converts the incoming bitstream into a logical tree, that's the message tree, so that in the compute node, you can code your transformation and then output it to the output node, where the parser then converts this message tree back into the bitstream in the desired XML format. And I'm just going through these just to sort of set a reminder. I think most of us joining this call are already familiar with it, but let's go on to slide number 6. So it's a logical structure here that is created as a result of parsing a message. The contents are obviously identical to the message, the incoming message, so that it can be manipulated. The message tree can be manipulated as per the user's requirement. And a new message tree is created for every flow invocation, and then it's cleared up once the flow is finished. Now, a screenshot example of a simple message tree is shown here at the bottom. Obviously, now, if a message is small, if you look at the tree screenshot here, if you can imagine if a tree is small, then the overhead of fully parsing that message would not be much. It would be quite small. The tree would be small. But as your message size grows, as your complexity grows, or your transformation logic gets tedious, then you would have to parse such a message to convert it into a tree structure, which can grow larger and larger. And then obviously the cost of fully parsing it would also become larger and larger, which would then result in a larger memory consumption. So in such cases, it becomes even more important to keep memory usage to minimum. Because if you don't take care of this ahead of time, at the time of designing your flow, you will experience the exponential growth on the data flow engine at runtime. And you would think it's just resulting into a data flow engine memory leak, because the memory just keeps on growing. So let's take a look at slide number 7. So then we were talking about the cost of parsing complex messages and complex message trees. So what can we do to prevent this memory usage from growing? There are some recommended practices around parsing messages, which we will discuss here. Regardless of the size of messages, these are some techniques that you can implement to simplify the logic within your message flows. Use compact parsers. The benefit of compact parsers is that they discard any white spaces or comments in the messages. So those portions of your input message are not populated in the message tree, and that keeps the memory usage a bit down. And the compact parsers are XML NSC for XML, DFDL for non-XML data. For those of you who are on the older versions of Message Broker and are familiar with MRM, MRM is also a compact parser. So parsing of a message will always begin from the start of the message, and proceed as far along the message as required in order to access the elements that are being referred to within your flow through your processing logic, whether using ESQL or Java or whatever your means might be. But depending on the field being accessed, if it may not be necessary to parse the whole message. If you're trying to access a field that is somewhere in between your message tree, you can only parse until that point and try to avoid parsing the rest of the message, which you may not even need. And we'll look into this in a little bit more detail. But basically, the rest of your if you don't parse the whole message, you can actually save some cost right there. Only the portion of the message that has been parsed will be populated in your tree, and that the rest of it will be just held as unprocessed bitstream. You can parse it subsequently in the flow also if you have a need for that, or you can just leave it unparsed and copy it just like that on the output. So if you know the message flow needs to process the whole message, I mean, there could be instances where you do need to process the whole of the message and you do need to parse the entire message, then you should parse the whole message on the very first reference to the field within the message itself. So that way you're not parsing it repeatedly as you're hopping from one compute node to another. And to make sure that you use that, you can use the property parse immediate or parse complete on the input node. The default option is parse on demand, and we'll look into that in the subsequent FOILs here in a second. But yeah, and then the next point here is for XML messages, you can also consider using opaque parsing technique. So this technique would allow the name subtrees of the incoming message to be minimally processed, if you will. What that means is that they will be checked for their completeness, but they will not be validated for the content. But the subtrees within the messages will be simply populated into the message tree. The subtrees will not be fully populated. You would just see the bitstream for the subtree will appear in the message tree, but you will not see the fully expanded tree for the subtree. And we'll look at that into a little bit more detail. So this FOIL basically gives you a snapshot of these different practices and techniques that we will be discussing in more detail in the later on FOILs. So let's go to slide 8, please. So parsing avoidance. So as we just discussed, one way of reducing your cost is to not parse the message at all. There are a couple ways of doing this. One way is to move the data that has to be parsed into the header. So you have the bitstream, the message, the actual user data, and you can move the fields, the required fields, into the header itself. So let's take for an example, if you have a routing application where the message flow just needs to route the message to different destinations based on value of one particular field, say that's the field C here in the message, then rather than parsing the bitstream, the body of the message, if you move the field containing that routing information, if you move that field from message body to message header, then you could significantly improve the processing cost there because it's much cheaper to parse the message header than the message body. The message header is the structure is already well known there, so it's much cheaper. And this is an example that talks about accessing element C. I mean, what if it's the element X, Y, or Z? And then you're parsing all the entire user data to access that element when you only need one specific element, which can easily be moved into the header. So here, like if you move that field to the RFH2 header for, or if you're using JMS and JMS header, if it's a JMS message, then you could save some of those costs. The other way would be to not, you know, don't send. No need to parse if you don't send. So if you don't send the entire data, if you don't send the entire body, you only send what is required, what is actually changed. So, for instance, if we take an example of broker being used as an intermediate application between two other applications, then you could tailor your solution so that the application that's sending the message only sends the data that has been changed in the message rather than the full message every time. And that would also reduce the size of the message. So if the size of the message is reduced, there's less thing to parse, therefore less processing cost right there and less memory being utilized. Let's move to slide 9, please. Another way of reducing these costs is by using partial parsing. All the parsers supplied with the broker, with IIV, basically, they support partial parsing. The amount of parsing that is done depends on which fields of the message would need to be parsed and where exactly are they contained in the message. So if you look at the example shown here, the part of the message that needs to be parsed is contained in element Z. Right, and you're parsing the header, MQMD, RFH2, and the complete user data, all the way to element Z. But in the second example, element Z is at the beginning of the message. So the parser stops right there as soon as it reaches element Z, as soon as it's found the element. So where you have the influence, if you have the influence over the message design, then as a best practice, ensure that the information that's needed for routing is placed at the start of the message and not at the end of the message. So if you were to have the user data bitstream reversed there, which means the element Z is at the beginning there, you are only parsing the header, RFH2, and just one single element. And you would, if your user data, if your bitstream, the actual data itself is kilobytes or megabytes, then you would not be parsing all of that. And when partial parsing is configured on the input nodes, so the IMQ input node or your file input node or TCP/IP input nodes, you can select there's a parser options tab there, and you can select the value on demand. Actually, that's the default value. So if you just leave it at default itself, you can easily without configuring anything on the node itself, as long as the message contains the bitstream and the element at the beginning, you're ready. Broker's already parsing, just is already in the mode of partial parsing. You can also configure it within your compute nodes using ESQL or your XPath expressions. The examples laid down there for your reference. Let's go to the next slide, slide 10. You can also use opaque parsing for XML messages. This technique basically allows the whole of your XML subtree to be placed in the message tree as a single element. So that's the key here. The entry in the message tree is the bitstream of the original input message. And the technique actually reduces the size of the message tree here, because your XML subtree is not being expanded into the individual elements. So your subtree is compressed, it's reduced, and if it's not expanded, then the cost of parsing is reduced because there's less of input message that is expanded and fewer individual elements are opened up and added to the message tree. So you can use opaque parsing where you do not need to access the elements of the subtree. So if you need to copy, let's say, a portion of your input tree to the output message, but you don't care what the contents in that contents look like in this particular flow, you can simply accept the content in the subfolder, and you would not have to validate this. Of course, you don't need to validate this or process it in any way. So you make sure the validation is disabled for opaque parsing, and then when you copy the contents, your subtree, your subfolder, isn't parsed. It's just copied over. One caveat here, it's only supported by XML namespace or XML NSC parsers. For XML NSC, you would specify opaque elements in the parser options tab, as you can see on the screenshot on this foil, bottom right. So if you look at MQ input node, the opaque elements is where you would define the subfolder structure. For XML NS, you could use ESQL, and again a sample example is being given there. Right, so let's go to slide 11. So what do you do to check the memory growth caused by parsers? You can capture resource statistics. I provided a hyperlink there that talks more about how you can configure, how you can run the resource statistics. And subsequently, Amar will also cover this part in a bit. But at runtime, the messages are processed, and as you're processing your messages through the flow, you can configure the broker to dump these resource statistics, and you can look at these fields, the approximate MKB, max read KB, max written KB, the number of fields, the number of fields that are associated with the message flow parser type. The number of reads, the number of failed reads. The ones that are really of interest are the approx mem KB, max read KB, and max written KB. You can also, at any given point, you can list out the active parsers in your EG, in your execution group, and look for the fields approx mem KB, if you run the report properties against the execution group, against COM IBM parser manager object, you would dump the approx mem KB along with a few other parameters there. But that's a single snapshot of what it looks like at that particular time. If you want to run it over a period of time to actually see how the trend looks like, then you need to run the resource statistics. So let's go to slide 12. That brings us to problem number two, memory growth with large files and large messages. Slide 13, please. So So messages that are in megabytes or gigabytes in size can be quite problematic, as, you know, you would need to populate all of them in the message tree if you're not using those techniques that we just talked about. But even if you are, even then, you know, it could be a requirement to parse the entire message. So firstly, you would need to parse. These large messages, they would need to be parsed. And then the large message tree would have to be carried over through your flow from across different nodes. And this would obviously increase your stack size, your native memory, or if you're using Java nodes, then of course you would experience growth on the Java memory usage and can result into memory exhaustion. But typically, these large messages contain lots of smaller individual messages, lots of smaller individual chunks that you can break these messages into. So most of the times you would see, and as example, it's a generic example that you can see there, you would see the repeating structures, which what I mean is you don't need to process the entire message together. You can process it in parts or chunks. And you can parse one chunk at a time and dump it into the folder, and this is at a high level, and then formulate the complete output bit stream and then spit it out. So this example XML document, it demonstrates an outer message that contains multiple inner messages, and the inner message is repeatable. So the message body inside of the inner message tag, that is repeatable. Let's go to slide 14. So with these kinds of messages, we still have a hope. There is a hope that if you use the large message processing techniques, you may not see the exhaustion. So obviously use partial parsing. All of the techniques that we talked about in the problem first, problem number one, they're still applicable. You can use, the other technique is use the delete statement in your ESQL, which would delete the portions from the parse tree that have been processed. So you don't carry them through the flow between different nodes. And this sort of technique can be applied to the data received from MQ sources as well as non-MQ sources. So you would see even on the files, you would see that you could split the files into such kind of chunks. And with files, for processing files, it's much easier. There is a property on the node that we'll talk about. It's parse record sequence that can be set on the file nodes or on the TCP/IP nodes, for instance. And then there are some environment variables of your interest when dealing with memory usage. We'll touch upon them as well, such as MQSI free master parsers, MQSI thread stack size. There's some JVM heap parameters, max JVM heap size, JVM native stack size. But use them with caution, especially the environment variables. If you blindly set them, you can actually have adverse effects. So it needs to be set by fully understanding what you're doing with them. And then, so there's a message splitter pattern that we have shipped with IIB version 9. And there is also a large messaging sample that was available even in the prior releases. But message splitter pattern, I think, is very straightforward, very, very easily adaptable. And you can configure it based on what you want to do within your flow. I mean, you can just take that, you can import that pattern and just customize it to your needs. It's a very generic, and I think it's a very powerful way of coding coding your flows to handle these kinds of large messages. Let's go to slide 15. So, right, in delete statement technique, you would copy the body of the input message as a bit stream to a special folder in the output message. So first you create a modifiable copy of your input message. It's only a copy. You're not parsing the message. You're only creating a copy, so you obviously, parsing would have costs associated with it. Copying would not. But the key steps in the processing are listed here. So a modifiable copy of your input message is made, and as the copy of your input message as I mentioned, you're not parsing it, you're just making a copy, you would use less memory. Then a loop and a reference variable would be used to process the message one record at a time. So you could create a loop there, and with the reference variable, just jump from one portion of inner message to the next. For each record, your contents are processed, and your output tree would be produced, and you would put that in the special folder that you created. You can use your asBitStream. You can serialize your bitstream to the output subtree. And finally, you can use the delete statement here, which would delete both your input and output record message trees when the processing has been finished. So right at the end of the node itself. So you're deleting the message tree at the end of your node processing, and that way you would not be carrying them through the nodes, and it would allow it would then allow your memory that would be released when you have the delete statement. The memory would be released and would be released back to the data flow engine to be reused subsequently. Data flow engine would not release it back to the operating system. It would be released back to the data flow engine so that subsequent processing can happen. And when all the records in the message have been processed, the special holders that you use to process your input and output streams can then be detached so they do not appear in the final message. So let's go to slide 16. This shows a snippet of an example. Basically, here you can see some of the sample ESQL calls for using the reference variables. You can see the loop that is used to locate your repeating structures, and then the delete previous sibling that would delete your record message trees once the processing is complete. This sample is taken from the message splitter pattern. If you import it, you would see this code there. Of course, it has a complete. I just copied the snippets of it, just to kind of highlight what we were discussing here. So let's go to slide 17. So like the MQ messages, if you're dealing with large files or large records, you would be using, say, file nodes or your TCP/IP nodes. You could use sparse record sequence technique, and that is the property record detection, which can be set on the file input node, as you can see on the screenshot there. This only works with XML NSC or DFDL or MRM parsers, so you're kind of restricted there. But this will allow your parser to determine the end of a logical record in your file, and each of these records would be processed individually would be propagated through the flow, and eventually you would have whole of the file that would be split up into sub-transactions. If you go to slide 18, you can see an example here. If you set the record detection property to parse record sequence, then a file containing multiple records, the multiple records there being this is a test created for this VSTI only. You would see the file containing multiple records would be parsed for individual records, and then split up into these multiple sub-transactions. So it's part of the same parent transactions, but would have individual sub-transactions. Let's go to slide 19. So as mentioned earlier, there are a couple of environment variables that may be applicable to your environment. Basically, there is an in-memory cache for parsers, which can keep growing at runtime as you're processing messages. The in-memory cache, the in-memory parser cache would hold your parsed structures. And this can keep growing and growing, and you may experience memory growth. So, if you export this environment variable, you would see that at the end of the parse processing, the parser will be freed up. After the message, instead of caching it, it would free it up and it would have lesser memory footprint on the data flow engine. There's some caveats associated with it. There's some APARs associated with it. And on the reference section towards the end of this presentation, I posted a link that talks about there is a blog post on the MQSI Free Master Parsers, so make sure you read through that if you're experiencing, if you're considering setting this in your environment. There's also another environment, MQSI Thread Stack Size, and Amar will be talking about it in more detail, but basically it allows you to increase your maximum size on the individual threads running within an execution group. Obviously, if you're setting this as an environment variable, you would apply it to the entire broker, or you can actually apply it. You would still apply it to all the threads running in the data flow engine. So normally, you would recommend such a this kind of variable if you have a very complex message flow, or if you have a very large message, incoming message that's coming through for processing, and you need larger thread stack size, the default's 1 MB. If you need larger than that, then you may need to set this. Then there are some JVM parameter values for JVM max heap size and JVM native stack size that you may want to tune when dealing with large messages. Now, from a troubleshooting perspective, there's not a straightforward way to determine if a bad logic may have been used to design or whether some of these techniques have been implemented in your design or not. So after the fact, it's kind of you would have to basically revisit your flow design and basically see if you've implemented these techniques or not. And that can obviously cause a lot of time in problem investigation. This actually applies to both problems 1 and 2 that we just discussed, but we would actually recommend that you use these preset sample, the preset, this message splitter pattern, if you're dealing with these kinds of situations. This way, you would you would be fixing those issues ahead of time. You would not be running into issues as a result of bad design. Let's look at slide number 20. That's basically the reason I've shown this slide here. Consider the use of patterns. It's better to design your flows to be as efficient as possible from day one rather than solving bad design later on, because it obviously costs more. Working around bad design can actually make your problems even worse at times. So use a working pattern if possible. Message splitter for handling large messages. In general, we have provided pattern solutions for different solutions, different scenarios, different use cases. We would encourage using them. And using pattern would prevent these problems that may occur due to inefficient design. So I would actually say, I would go on to the extent of saying if you ever have to open a PMR, and if you've used a pattern, say that, just let us know ahead of time. That way we would not waste time and look at your flow design from the perspective of seeing if you followed the best practices, the recommended practices or not. So if you follow the pattern, then we know that these recommended practices would have been followed in your design, and we can move on to the next aspect of troubleshooting. So let's go to slide 21. Brings us to problem number three, and I hand over the presentation to Amar to cover the remaining foils.
Okay. Thanks, Vivek. My name is Amar Shah, and I will be taking the rest of the session on the problems that are related to runtime. So Vivek basically covered most of the aspects of message flow design time considerations, how that can help in managing the memory and performance in much better fashion. So what I'm going to take you through is, so when it comes to the runtime, when you have actually deployed your message flows and solutions, and then you experience some of those memory issues, and then how do you go about identifying the root cause and resolving the problems. So we will first look at the differences or the terminology that most often we use while dealing with the memory-related PMRs. So memory leak and fragmentation. So there is always a confusion whether you are experiencing a memory leak or a fragmentation. So we will look at in more detail in the following slides. So can we move on to slide number 22? Okay. So let's try to understand on very generic terms of what do we mean by fragmentation and what do we mean by memory leak. So fragmentation, I think most of us are aware in terms of the disk fragmentation, that you have some chunks in the disk that are empty but not being used. So similar thing happens for memory as well. So as process gets memory allocated, deallocated, there are some holes left in the heap of the process which is not usable because of the size or because of the request of the allocations that may not have that contiguous block available on the heap. So if you see an example here, you have a process heap with 1900 kilobytes free, and you make a request for 1000 kilobytes, but that allocation cannot be satisfied because there is no continuous block available of 1000 kilobyte size. And that is where the process ends up requesting more memory from the operating system. Right? So that is one cause of why your process would grow intermittently. The other aspect to see is the memory leak. So when we talk about memory leak, it is something that is not written back after giving it to you. This process has requested certain amount of memory. When it has done processing with that, it is supposed to return it back to the process heap. When it does not return all of that or part of that back to the heap, then it starts to accumulate that as a usable chunk of that memory on the heap. And slowly it will exhaust the available heap, and then it will keep requesting more and more from the operating system. So that is when you will see a gradual increase in the processor's memory usage. And that is a kind of an indication that there is a potential memory leak. Can we move on to slide number 23? So let's try to understand it from the broker perspective, how broker uses memory for its own purpose. So the main engine or the main process in the message broker is the data flow engine, which what we call execution group, where your message flows are deployed. So when you create an execution group and when you deploy message flows to it, there are a certain number of objects that are created on the process heap, and that lasts for the life of the execution groups. So once you have deployed a message flow, that will always be there in the execution group until you undeploy it. Right? So it occupies certain space on the heap. Then execution group also has its own JVM to serve the Java-related operations. So that also resides inside your native address space. So every message flow is in turn a thread within the execution group. So you deploy more number of message flows and more number of threads will be created, and they will have their own storage area reserved for execution of the message flow. And every thread has its own stack to store the temporary variables, the local variables, the function stack, right? So those are the fixed cost for the data flow engine memory usage. Can we move on to slide number 24? Thank you. So what do we need to understand about brokers' use of memory? There are certain guidelines or principles, I think, that are always true in terms of the process, the way it uses the memory, right? So data flow engine is a process in your operating system that will grow in size to satisfy the storage request as you deploy more flows, as you start to process messages through your message flow, right? And when the message processing is complete, our general expectation would be that memory should be released back to the operating system. But take it, for example, AIX, you would always see the message has been processed by the message flow. The size of the execution group has increased to a certain extent, and after the processing, it doesn't come back to the original level. The reason is that once the memory is allocated on the heap, and when the processing is over, the freed memory is not given back to operating system, but it remains with the data flowing process for the reuse for the subsequent messages. The third point is that how long this behavior should continue. So usually when you start the broker or the data flow engine, the initial few messages will really require certain objects on the heap for initialization, and there will be some fragmentation effect where there may be enough number of blocks but not of the size to satisfy the allocation request for the incoming messages. So when that happens, keeps happening for the first few messages, and what should happen as the message flows or the data flow engine starts to stabilize on message processing is to reach a plateau point where you would not see the growth on the memory usage as you would have seen at the beginning of the execution group. startup, right? So the plateau point is a point where memory heap has got enough storage to satisfy all types of requests coming from all its threads and message flows and for all sizes of messages. So in your environment, you may be processing messages of different sizes. So when the threads are able to satisfy the allocation request for the largest size processed by the message flow, I think that is the point when it will start to show the sign of plateau, which means memory usage will not grow beyond that point, if assuming there is no memory leak with the product. Slide number 25. Yeah. So obviously, so when you are processing messages in your environment and when you are monitoring your data flow engine for the memory usage, you will typically have few questions. Should execution group be using so much of storage? And why it is not reaching a plateau? When will it reach the plateau? So these are the very basic questions that typically come into anyone's administrator's perspective. And they tend to suspect that there is a memory leak, right? And it is very difficult to prove whether it's a memory leak or the growth is legitimate just by looking at the environment. So it definitely requires some deterministic steps to narrow down the cause of the growth, whether it is a legitimate growth and it should plateau at some point in time, or is there any really a memory leak with the product that is causing this continuous growth. So let's look at an example on slide number 26, right? So the way we try to advise our customers on isolating the cause of the memory growth is first of all, if possible, if you are suspecting any of the flows that are contributing to this memory growth, we advise them to isolate to the separate execution group so that it can be monitored in a more controlled fashion. Since we talked about the fragmentation aspect, the fragmentation is more apparent when you are processing different size of messages through your message flow. So we advise them to process the same input message repeatedly into the message flow so that it nullifies the effect of fragmentation and shows the signs of plateau. So if it reaches the plateau, then we know that there is no memory leak. But if it doesn't reach a plateau, then it takes to the next step of identifying what is within this message flow causing a memory leak. So when these tests are carried out, we suggest to run it on a longer duration to allow the fragmentation effect to be nullified and the data flow engine should start to show some plateau. For that, we suggest customers to monitor some of the simple memory user statistics using PS command, and some examples are shown on slide number 27. Right? So I have taken a couple of examples here, one to show how a memory leak would manifest when you plot a graph now for a memory usage over a period of time, and how a fragmentation can be determined. So that is shown on the right hand side of the graph, where you can see the memory usage curve starts to flatten up. That is, they are the signs of the plateauing, and you could safely assume that there is no memory leak experienced by your message flows. On the left-hand side, you could see the graph is continuously growing over a period of time, and it's not showing any signs of flattening. So that is an indication where you could suspect a memory leak with the product. Right. We'll move on to slide number 28. Okay. So let's look at some of the common scenarios where a fragmentation can be very apparent and which could lead to a false perception of memory leak. So especially the processing on the characters and the blob messages, if they are not done using the recommended practices, then you are likely to increase the fragmentation in the processor's heap size. So some examples are typically concatenation of the strings or replacing the some certain characters from the blob message using the techniques shown here. Those are the techniques or those are the examples that are surely going to cause more fragmentation. Right? So we'll move on to slide number 29. Okay. So here, that was an example on the previous slide. It was an example on ESQL. And on this slide, there is an example on the Java string manipulation. So if you are trying to concatenate a string using Java Compute Node, I think the suggested or recommended way is to use a string buffer mechanism that is shown in the bottom part of this slide, which will reduce the amount of storage that is required for a string object on the heap, and how the string buffer append operation can reduce the memory usage, as well as it will also perform much better than the plus operator. We'll move on to slide number 30. Okay. So apart from this ESQL coding practices, additional instances also has an effect on the fragmentation. So since additional instances are a configurable property for the message flows, they are not started all at once, unless you have set a property to do so. But since they get instantiated randomly based on the incoming load, the memory allocation patterns will be quite random when you are using memory additional instances. And that is when the allocations on the heap will not be as optimum as with the one single instance thread. Right? So if you are working with additional instances, you will have to allow more time for the process to reach the stabilization level. That is what we call a plateau level. Can we move on to slide number 31? Okay. So we will also now look at what are the causes of memory growth in JVM component. As we know, JVM is a as an embedded component within the data flow engine. It has its own space, which it occupies from data flow engine's heap, and the effect of JVM usage can also give you the indications whether you are experiencing the memory issues, whether within the JVM or whether it is due to the native. So let's look at some of those aspects. Can we move on to slide number 32? Okay. So just a small introduction on where the Java is being used within the data flow engine. So every execution group creates its own JVM to provide the processing for Java-based nodes, so Java Compute Node, XSLT nodes, right, and the nodes that are written in Java. So it could be your user-defined node, or it could be the nodes like file nodes, TCP/IP nodes, and SAP nodes. The Java heap is also used for processing SAP IDOCs, and if you are calling some external Java programs from your ESQL or mapping nodes, they also require space on the JVM. So how do you determine that whether my Java heap is sufficient? and should I need to tune it further for better performance or to avoid any memory exhaustion scenarios. So it is there is no set rule that will tell you that this is a recommended value. So this has to be an iterative process to arrive at an optimum value for your JVM heap size. And some of the key indicators are the garbage collection overheads, how much garbage collection is happening, what is the frequency, and what is the pause times. Usually those pause times and GC overheads tend to slow down the things because they stop everything when they are in action. So can we move on to slide number 33? Right. So you may have different requirements based on the kind of processing your message flows are designed for. So if you have designed a message flow as a batch processing activity, then your garbage collection should be minimum. And if you have designed the real-time message flows, then the pause times should be as minimum as possible. So there are some suggested approach to tuning the JVM heap size. So the default sizes are 32 MB for the minimum heap size. That is the size which the data flow engine will allocate by default as a lower level. And maximum heap size that it can grow is 256 megabytes. So if you are using large messages, if your records are very large, or if you have too many Java processing within your message flows, then you would have to look at increasing the maximum heap size so that you don't end up into out of memory errors. Can we go on to slide number 34? Right. So how do you determine how much of JVM is being used currently? So resource statistics provide you a live information on how the JVM heap is being used by data flow engine. And there are certain statistics like what's the max allocation, that is the max heap size, then how much is currently in use that you can see it using used memory in MB. And you can also see what is the garbage collection intervals or how frequently the garbage collections are happening and how much time is being spent in garbage collection. So all the statistics are available through resource statistics for JVM. Slide number 35. Right. Okay, so there are a couple of scenarios where you could run out of JVM heap size and you may end up using out of memory errors. One could be the legitimate growth because you have some large messages or large Java processing that is not fitting within the default size of the JVM heap size. So in those situations, you would understand from the resource statistics that you would need to increase the maximum heap size to allow for the extra Java workload. And if there is a genuine memory leak within the JVM components, then obviously the growth of the JVM will keep happening. And the easiest way to identify whether there is a memory leak within the JVM is to collect the garbage collection trace and then use the Java Health Center to get the report on whether there is a suspected memory leak within the JVM. And you can enable the Java garbage collection trace in the message broker using MQSR JVerbose or one of the MQSR change properties on COM IBM JVM Manager. Okay. Can we move on to slide number 36? Okay. So we'll look at a few examples where memory growth is also resulted due to the caching of the objects. Can we move to slide number 37? Okay. So typically the ESQL which interact with the databases, the SQL statements, they are the cause for most of the objects being cached. The reason is SQL prepare is a statement that is used to create the definition of your SQL statement that will be executed against the database, and that is a costly call, and hence for the performance reason this SQL prepared statements are always cached, so that if you have similar request coming in the next message, the SQL prepare will not spend extra time in preparing the statement again, rather than it will use the cache. So if you are using hard-coded parameters in your SQL statement, what happens that those statements are cached and they cannot be used for the next message if the data of one of the parameter changes. So I have an example on the later slide where I will show how the prepare statement can end up doing more caching of the objects. The other aspect to look at is the pass-through statements. Pass-through statements also result into caching of the statements for the performance reasons. And if you are not using parameter markers, then every statement that is executed will be cached rather than being reused and be replaced only for the data part. So there are these caching also resides on your heap, and that also could cause memory fragmentation. Can we move to slide number 38? Okay. So as I discussed about the thread stack previously, so every thread will have its own stack storage to process the message flows and the nodes and the local variables associated with those nodes. So if you have included some loops, some while loops, or if you have some hard-coded looping between the nodes, then all of that processing goes onto the thread stack. So default stack of 1 MB or 2 MB would not be sufficient to hold that amount of recursiveness. And you will end up having a situation where you have to then increase the thread stack, otherwise your message flow would fail. So if you increase the thread stack, that has an effect on all the threads running within the data flow engine. And that will eventually cause the extra memory storage being allocated to the process. And that is where you would also see some excessive memory being used by data flow engine. And obviously, these will cause more fragmentation. And again, you would reach the plateau point much later than you would have done with using some of the best practices. Can we move to slide number 39? Right. So, yeah, so these are some of the examples I was talking about, the ESQL caching. So if you look at the statements in the later part of the slide, is pass-through being used with the hard-coded string on the data, like price equal to 100 and company is equal to IBM. And if you execute this statement and if you get another message with different values here and with a different company, then this statement, which is cached, will not be reused. Rather, the pass-through will create another cached object for executing another statement, which looks similar but has different data. Right? So if you see at the bottom of the slide, there is an example that how you could use some of the best practices of using a parameter marker to call such statements which can be reused again and again. Thus, they will reduce the memory requirement for storing the cache objects. Slide number 40, please. Okay, so I think we have reached our end of our presentation or the topics that we wanted to cover in this session. So there are some references on this page which will guide you to some of the best practices, some of the techniques, and the info center pages for the product. So this concludes our presentation. So I'll hand it over to Kathy.
Thank you, Vivek and Amar, for a great presentation. Before we get to the question and answer session, I would like to conduct a short poll. There are four questions that will appear in the web conference, and we appreciate your participation. One thing to know about these, we had a comment during our last session. The odd numbers for these answers, they're gray, and then the even numbers are in bold. You can select the grade numbers, so like that number one, they're strongly agreed, it's kind of grayed out. It is a selection that you can choose for these polling things. But for the first question, on a scale of 1 to 5, choose a number that best describes what you think about this statement. The information presented today was useful to me. 1, strongly agree. 2, agree. 3, neutral. 4, disagree. 5, strongly disagree. And so now we will move on to the question answer session. There is a question in the chat. A question came in from Sarah. How does one set the MQSIJ verbose? Did you say to use MQSI change properties?
Yeah, so this is Amar. So MQSIJ verbose is an environment variable that can be set in the user's profile when they're starting the broker. And the other way of setting the property for the JVM is by using MQSI change properties command, using com IBM JVM manager as an object. So there is a JVM system property that can be set to minus verbose colon GC to enable the garbage collection trace for the data flow engine.
There are no other questions. So at this time, we will conclude the presentation. Thank you for joining us, and thank you, Vivek and Amar, for presenting today. You all have a great day.